FBI for the chance of here visiting and stuff. Okay. Well, what I'm going to be talking about today is how to use this scattering theory of Magnus to study the problem of scale dimensions in the primary limit of an equal force for your mist. And as this reflected in the title, I would like to discuss how, I mean, most of the developments in the last years in this action were in the case of single trace operators, and which are the dual law of closed strings. But these ideas can be extended to operators dual to open strings ending on the arrays. So, well, my model's contribution was in this couple of papers, but of course I'm going to be reviewing a lot of work done by others. So, starting point should be the motivation. Why to worry about this problem? Well, AES EFT is interesting from, I mean, the list of the motivation for assigning AES EFT is long. Maybe the most remarkable one is that AES EFT is it could be a tool to for studying the strong coupling regime of a gauge theory by looking at the dual point of view, which is going to be a theory of gravity formulated in a space-time which is weakly curved. So, but precisely because of this strong weak coupling nature of the correspondence is also the reason why it is very difficult to imagine a proof of the correspondence, and it is also difficult to construct explicit test of the correspondence. In order to do that, one it is desirable to have a description of something physically interesting in the models as exactly as a function of the top coupling. If one succeeds in doing that, one then can try to take the limit of weak coupling and strong coupling and to see if this description exactly in the top coupling is able to interpolate between the regimes accessible by explicit computations, the weak and the strong coupling. So, well, this is the goal of this scattering problem that I'm going to be talking about, and the ultimate goal is to work it out the spectrum of scale dimensions exactly as a function of the gauge of the coupling constant. Notice that in a CFT, this could be equivalent to know all the two-point correlation functions of this sector of the theory. And I'm going to be talking about the Larchen limit. This is not because I'm interested in that limit. It's just because it is in that limit that integrability appears in the problem. And integrability is going to be the cornerstone of what I'm going to be talking about today. And well, it's also why it is interesting to look for other integrable structures in this problem or related problems. In particular, I will be looking how to consider open boundary conditions which are integrable. Well, why open? Well, this is just not interesting for the sake of completitude. One can see that in many cases, the inclusion of these d-brains will require the inclusion of fundamental matter in the gauge theory, so which is always an appealing situation. And also that some of the finite size corrections that at the end of the day one would like to incorporate could be easier to incorporate in the case of open boundary conditions. I think so, yes, it is. Well, but, I mean, integrability, you cannot rule out integrability.
You can prove that the problem is integral, you can fail fully. I mean, it's difficult to say that. I mean, the statement is integrability was, it is
proved only. Only at Larchen. Are there anybody who tried GF1, things like that?
No. So, it's only a planar effect.
Well, I mean, in the plane wavelet.
No. Well,
in the game server.
Not necessarily in the plane of things. I mean, you can.
I'm saying that there were non-plenal corrections of the RNG.
Oh, okay. But I would have the gravity in that case.
So will the integrability help you construct all the Wien's functions in the theories? Or just 2 points?
No, that's integrability would help you to know exactly, but we are not there yet, but it could be that you are able to work out exactly the effect of the scale dimension of operator. Like knowing the scale dimension of a certain set of operators is enough just to know the 2-point correlation function, but it's not enough to tell you more points. So it is also misleading to say that this could be a proof of AD and CFD in the planar limit because we can compare about 2 points. So, well, let me just explain what example of AD CFD I did on the ground, which is a typical one. Then I will review how this map between operators and strings in the AD CFD game and how this problem is mapped to the problem of they're analyzing the arbitrary of certain spin chains. And then since those spin chains are going to be linked together, I will just briefly review how to use the vector answer to solve the respective problem of this spin chain. It is just using certain scattering description of magnets to work out the wave function of the problem. But that is one of the motivations to find something which is exact, meaning no explicit dependence on the coupling, on the top coupling. And I will try to show you briefly how to, well, I can use the symmetries of the problem to obtain the scattering matrix dependence exactly on the top coupling. And of course, I will try to how this is extending when you also have boundaries on your chain. I can't really like to sketch how one would need to box it to incorporate finite size connections. Okay, as I said, in ACFT, for me, basically, we just the conjecture equivalence between any perforce with the enemies, we get to residue any four dimensions. And this is tied to be string theory when it's forgetting this pattern of ideas. It's fine. But it's very precise. Why is the conjecture? Well, this is not an equivalence to just the theory, but to Fermi, yes, to Fermi theories. Each of them are labeled by two dimensional parameters. For instance, in the range theory, you have the rank of the gauge group and also the gauge coupling constant. And the subtlety that you know, the theory cannot deal with the theory for any value of those parameters. You just can work in very restricted corners of this space of parameters. For instance, in the Laplacian limit, you can analyze the field theory just by two material in powers of the top coupling, which is this combination between the gauge coupling and the gauge group. And you can trust this perturbative approach as long as lambda is much smaller than one. While you can trust the semi classical description. In the same class of strings of plurality, in the plurality dual, only when the size of the space is larger than the string unit. So, this, when you translate it into the gauge parameter, this corresponds to lambda much larger than one. So, that's the problem I was telling you. So, we have an equivalence between two theories, but the implicit machine we can access. Right? Standard perturbative computations in both theories are opposite. So, what is desirable, what we'd like to notice is the behavior of the theory in between, or something of the theory in between. And then, if it's possible to take in the weak and strong coupling limit, you can recover the.
Sorry, on the, is it known on the field theory side? So, I think I've heard that the perturbative expansion in lambda has a finite radius of convergence. So, is it known anything about one over n, the non-planar correction expansion? Does it have a finite radius of convergence? What's the story on that side?
Well, Yeah, well, I don't know much about the sub-leading correlation to the.
Sorry, what was the question?
Well, I was asking just on the field theory side, how much is known about perturbative expansion? So I think the story is that the expansion in Hoofdkoppling has a finite radius of convergence, but I don't know. My question was about one of the N expansion.
Yeah, one linear. So.
But you expect it. It won't converge.
Why? Sorry, why? Why do I expect that it will not converge?
So, well, one of my constant correction in gravity.
No, I'm not doing anything on the gravity side. I'm just doing on the.
Yeah, I'm asking. You expect that to. Expect that it will fully go up to string theory and then.
No, I don't want to care. I don't care about the equivalence. I'm asking. So, as a field theory question, right?
Is it not a renormal problem?
I don't know.
So you have the Angular's instanton. Isn't that a sign that the field theory perturbative expansion does not is only asymptotic? I mean, it's not Borel-Sommerville.
Somehow the instantons are not important, right, for the plane element.
Yeah, that, I mean, the plane element, you're right, yeah.
You'd expect renormals to kick in for instantons anyway. Is there some reason you wouldn't expect them to break?
But we have lots of supersymmetry, so. I was just asking. You're saying that it has zero radius of convergence because of.
No, I don't know. I would expect it to be. Well, if there weren't renormals, it'd have to be some good reason for them not. Yeah.
I will not attempt any perturbative expansion in whatever, just keep working on the string, taking the limit of the run of the machine. So, what I'm going to be discussing today seems to be so very much. So, as I said, it's always people focus on the strict limit. So that's a picture of what the correspondence says about the spectrum of energies when it's computing global recording of 8 years should exactly correspond to the spectrum of scalar measures of operators when the field theory is formulated in flat and cross space. And here is how you can train this description, this computation of scalar measures into the diagonalization of the Hamiltonian circle expansion. For instance, for the simpler case of the correspondence between lots of strings and single space operators, of course, the element just comes to the interface. In any unfortunate domain, you have a gauge field, six real scalars, four Dirac fermions, but let us focus only in a subsector in which we don't see a single trace is made out of only two scalar scalar fields. And just for convenience, to label the operators, you can think of each Z factor as a spin up and each Y factor as a spin down. So you can just describe the full space of these single traces in this subsector as the states in the periodic.
If you're matching up with the scale, so when you match the spectrum of strings with the scale dimension.
Yeah.
Right. There are other operators besides the single trace operators that have the same protected conformal dimension. So how do you know that these strings match up just with the single trace operators and not, say, some admixture of single trace operators and other operators with the same protected dimension?
I think that the way of motivating this identification is this. You don't expect that. For example, there is an operator with two single traces, but the same total angular momentum, R charge, which is the deal of the angular momentum, is orthogonal to, in a total limit, to the operator with a single trace. So, this is more or less what you would expect if you have a figure of a state string and the angular momentum should be applied to an extended two open two cross strings with a single angular momentum. So this orthogonality is can be introduced by single trace vector, but of course this is not valid in general. This is no longer true if the length of this single trace is larger than the square root of L. This is start to fail, and then you have to if that happens, you are not only having close change, you have big range, just like gravitons. But as soon as, let's say, the length of the end of the trace is smaller, or the order, at most the order of the square root of the length of the eight loop, you have this orthogonality. And then you, I mean, as far as I know, this is the most. So, okay, so far that was, I mean, this identification between single traces of the state of a spin chain of. Where the spins are spins of the fundamental of facing two, it's just something pictoric. I mean, it's just for the sake of labeling the state. But if you go on and you compute the correlation function to work it out, how do they mix at one loop and which is operator, you have to be analyzed to so work it out with one loop correction for all the dimensions. You made exactly this operator, but it's just a permutation between two spins and neighboring size. And this is nothing but exactly the Hamiltonian of the Heisenberg spin chain model, the XXX spin chain model, which is integral. And then you can use the better answer to what you can call the completely the spectrum of this Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So, for example, you can organize any state depending on the number of spins that are fixed. So if you have all the spins with the same orientation, or the spin ups, this could correspond based on the set spins. Of course, this is an C and a value, and that's right, but this will be a operator, so it's protected at one loop and then you have higher loops. But then you can flip one of the spin, which is replaced one of the set by a Y frame. And if you put the map, you know, the spin field with this momentum P in the chain, forget about for the moment all the realistic conditions. And if you act with this Hamiltonian in this state, you see that this is an exact eigen function in this eigen value, proportional to this square of the sine of P over 2. So we want to go on and now work it out for two magnets and so on. For two magnets, the naive will be just okay. Just put superpose, consider the superposition of these two individual magnets, and this is almost an eigen state because the rank of interaction is Hamiltonian is only the nearest neighbors. So as soon as n is n one is much larger than n, so this is smaller than n two minus one. This is it's fine, but when the two impurities are, the two numbers are in negative size, this is no, there is a failure on this linear state. So the way of solving that is just, so here I put this proposition of the left particle with momentum p1 and the right particle with momentum p2. And you could add the term with what the momentum has been exchanged, and you can detect this as a scattering process.
And then for this to be an eigen state, you can work it out the dependence of this scattering factor for this to be an exact eigen function of the of this Heisenberg Hamiltonian. If you use this dependence on p1 and p2, this is an exact eigen function of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian with this the energy is just the sum of the energy of the energies of individual magnets. So, but as I said, this is for two, then you should need to work it out the same for n magnets. Here is when you can profit from integrability. Integrability says that the scattering factor for n magnets should be, it should be possible to write it as the product of only two Magnon scattering factors. For instance, for these three Magnon scattering factors, you can just think of these three subsequent two Magnon scattering processes taking place, and write this scattering factor as the product of the scattering factors of two Magnons. So the bottom line of the better answer is that the only thing you need to know for constructing all the eigenstate of the Heisenberg Hamiltonian or any other integral model is the two Magnon scattering matrix. Well, in this case, it's only a scattering factor. And then the sum of the energies of individual Magnons will give you the total eigenvalue of the wave function. Yeah. Where? Well, in principle, you don't know that this would be an exact eigenfunction of the. Well, in principle, it's not granted that. I mean, it's a semantical discussion, but I think in principle, you are not granted that just by super considering this superposition, this is going to be an eigenstate of. Anyway, so if we were considering infinitely long chains, that would be it. The momentum can be anything for each element and for each individual Magnon. But then, if you think of a finite size chain and then impose periodic boundary conditions, for instance, the wave function has to be periodic if you move one each individual Magnon all along the chain. And this, of course, is going to impose M restrictions, which is can be written in terms of the scattering factors in this way. And instead of having continuum values for the momentum, you have a set of discrete values for the momentums, which are going to be solutions of the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. But it was so far for the one loop and a very restricted SE2 sector. We would like to work it in a more general way, and this two generalization first. We want to consider more general operators. But we can still think of spin chains where the vacuum is going to be one of the scalar fields, and think of any of the other possible fields you can add, which are many other scalar. All the other scalar fields you have in equal parts of Riemann Mills, the fermions, covariant derivatives. So the impurities are now not only is you have to specify the position on the chain, but also the flavor or the kind of impurity you are placing in the chain. So you can think that this has flavor, and in a scattering state, this orientation in this flavor state can change. So these scattering factors are really scattering matrices. Now, for integrability to work, I mean, this factorization of, for instance, the three Magnon scattering in terms of two, you have to be careful because there is always more than one way of performing this factorization. For instance, in this case, you can factorize in these two different subsequent orders. So you need, I mean, these matrices, this is a non-trivial condition, the two-point scattering matrix. And it has to be satisfied if you want to be dealing with an integral S matrix. So another generalization we want to make, the motivation for this was if it is possible to work it out an S matrix and to know exactly the all loop expansion of the S matrix in all loop order in the top coupling. So we want to go farther than one loop. Notice that as soon as you increase the order in your loop expansion, you increase the range of interaction in the spin chain. So, but certainly we don't know the all loop spin chain Hamiltonian. So how can we know about the two basic ingredients of the better answer, which are the dispersion relation, so which is the amount of energy which each elementary magnon is going to contribute to the eigenvalue. And the exact S matrix, which is the what we need to construct the explicit wave eigenfunctions. So, well, this is what Bessel did essentially. So we are, first we are going to be thinking of a very long chain in order to avoid that the range of the interaction can be longer than the length of the chain, because in that case you have to incorporate wrapping effects, which for the moment I'm going to omit. But then you can think of the symmetries of the problem. So I haven't talked much about this PSU2.2/4 are the symmetries of ADS phi cosus phi, or the global symmetries of the field theory. Let me just talk about the bosonic part of that. It's SO2.4 × SO6. And of course, if you take this single trace operator, it's a VPS operator, it's going to be invariant under half of the supersymmetry, but it's only going to be invariant under part of the bosonic super. So in fact, since it has dimension, it's going to break scale dimension, so it's invariant only on under Lorentz, SO1.3. And also it carries an up charge, so it's going to break SO6 to SO4. Essentially, this SO1.3 × SO4 is the bosonic part of this SU2/2². So now, what is the picture we have? We have a ground state, which is going to be like the background where our magnets are going to be propagating, has this global symmetry. So we want, and it's natural to think that the impurities which are propagating in this background to accommodate into irreducible representations of this SU2/2². So I don't want to be, for instance, it's easy to see that these four scalars, these four covariant derivatives plus 8 of the 16 fermions you have in equal 4 supremes can be accommodated in the fundamental representation of this SU2/2². So let me just talk a little bit about this supergroup. Like you can just take one single factor of these two. Well, what is SU2/2 is the even part of the bosonic part, is two SU2 groups generated by this R and L, respectively, but also certain fermionic or supersymmetry generators, Q and S. There is also a central extension, which when you work it out, the reduction from this to this, you see that this central extension is precisely the anomalous dimension. So it's the scale dimension minus the R charge, which would be the classical scale dimension of the operator. So this is essentially what we are after. The anomalous, this central charge is going to be related to the anomalous dimension. And this central charge appears in the commutator of Q and S. But what Bessel realized is that this SU2/2, in principle, also admits two additional central extensions in the commutator of Q with Q and S with S. This one has to be the complex conjugate of each other. Another thing you have to bear in mind is that we want to be talking about magnons, and magnons also carry another quantum number, which is the momentum. So somehow you need this quantum number momentum of a magnon to be related to these two additional central charges. Another thing you have to have in mind is that in the original symmetry of the ground state, these additional central charges are zero, so are absent. So physical states need to have vanishing P and K, but not necessarily each individual magnon. So in the same way that once you want to write down a physical wave function, you have to impose cyclicity of the trace, and this restricts that the sum of all the momentum of all the magnons in a single trace has to be zero. So you can allow the magnons to carry these additional central charges as soon as these additional charges, when you sum over all magnons you have, the net additional central charge is zero. So and this is what Bison did, and you, in order to satisfy this constraint, you are led to this relation between the additional central charges and the momentum of the magnet. So let us focus, for instance, the most elementary magnets you can consider are those transforming in the fundamental representation of this. You can also have other representations, but let us focus on this example. So this R generator only mixes, so this is a four-dimensional representation. You have two bosons and two fermions. The first SU2 generators rotates the bosons, those rotates the fermions, and then you have the supersymmetry generator that transform bosons into fermions and fermions into bosons. And the most general representation of this SU2/2 can have arbitrary A, B, C, and D parameters as long as you satisfy this constraint. So you can label all the representation, all the fundamental representation of this SU2/2 by this A, B, C, D parameters subject to this constraint, or equivalent, since there is a relation between these parameters and the central extension, by the central extension C, B, and K. And now, you have this constraint, so the fundamental magnet has also this constraint between the central charges. And now using the expression, in this case, I'm talking about the most general representation of, I'm talking about representations of SU2/2. From the Archimedes point of view, A, B, C, and D can be anything. Then you want to think of a fundamental representation of this SU2/2 as certain magnon propagating in certain momentum. So in order to do that, you have if the magnon has momentum P, you have to allow for the magnon to have these central extensions. What you have, and it's not clear that this is the only solution, but I am probably it is. It's not easy to see. It's certainly you have to satisfy this constraint that the sum of, once you sum over all p's, this is zero because of the sum of all momentum is zero. So, but it's not obvious that this implies that this is a unique solution of the relation. Sorry?
The function doesn't follow from a one loop Feynman diagram.
Well, for the moment, there is nothing about Feynman diagram, and this G can be anything. And afterwards, once I work it out, the dispersion relation, I will need to look at the explicit Feynman diagram.
If you do this at one loop, you will find that the natural object field is the argument of G.
Well, I guess that is what I'm saying. So far I'm talking algebraically, but then at some point you have to relate, you have to say what is this in terms of the of couplings.
Yeah.
And looking at Feynman, explicit Feynman diagrams is what allows you to relate this to lambda. And I think it's the same. So
actually, how do you say that it is a solution?
How is this?
So you want to start with sum of little pi to zero and say if sum of capital pi and capital k are
zero. You have to use the telescopic property of this expression. But I mean, so now if you use this expression for express C as a function of the momentum, you will exactly use this partial relation. And exactly when you for so far G will be anything, any function of the capital. But what you realize is that for this in order to match the weight capping expansion, which is going to be the sine squared I was showing you in the Heisenberg case. You need this to be a precise function of the capping. And in fact, when you look at strong capping, you need to say it is by no means always that it has to be a simple function. For instance, in this new version of ADS CFT, ADS 4 times CP3,
you have a very similar scenario because you have, again, the same residual symmetry, you have SU2/2. And then when you work it out the dispersion relation, you get the same, but there is no reason for this to be a simple function. So in fact, in that case, the equivalent of the analogs of G is something which is order lambda squared with Kaplan, but it's proportional to lambda over 2 in U. So but it's just, it's called an axiom or the particularity or the feature of any equal force of the initial, you can have this simple expression for G, and there is no proof of that. So you have to do it. Yes, as I commonly am by using a totally different approach in a paper with Samuel and David Bernstein, we were working with matrix model, we were able to obtain this square root dispersion relation, but in that case, we didn't need to fix the factor lambda over pi over 2 was an outcome of our relation. So, but then, this is part of the schedule. What we're using in the inflection case, you can now demand that this scattering matrix is going to preserve the residual symmetry. Essentially, it's going to commute with the generators. And this is going to impose so many constraints that you can fix completely this huge S matrix, which is 16 squared times 16 squared. It's going to be completely fixed up to an overall factor. Of course, if you want to claim that you know the scattering matrix exactly as a function of lambda, you have to work it out with this overall factor, because this overall factor is also going to be a function of lambda. But this can be done using something called cross symmetry, which is standard in relativistic field theory, but it can be also imposed in this scenario. And let me just mention that this very non-trivial, this matrix you get satisfies the maximum. So this is a strong indication that this is internal.
The lambda equation does not constrain the field theory.
Does not?
Does not constrain the phase function.
No, because it's like
just commutation.
You see that you have here, yes, it's like a commutation. We can put an overall factor in the three matrices on them. So how do you extend this for open boundary conditions? So you're not going to need only the bulk scattering matrix for the numbers in the table, so we're going to have the boundary scattering matrix of the reflection matrix. For instance, already for the wave function of a single magnet, if you put just a magnet with momentum p, it's not going to be an exact eigen function. You need to add a term with a magnet in the opposite direction, and eventually you need to fix this scattering factor or matrix to be this an exact eigen function. Yes.
What are you computing in this case? The dimension?
Well, I'm going to be more precise. It's going to be the scale dimension of different operators. For the moment, I've just been scheduled, and then I mean, eventually put up the operators I'm mixing and continuing. Again, for this, for interability of open boundaries, again, you have a requirement of that now the reflection of two magnets have to be, can be written. I mean, in terms of factors of reflection of individual magnets and also some, maybe this too sketchy, this plot. But the factor in this case is
just a box.
So what you have is this boundary, and then you have a magnet can even with momentum p and be very reflective with momentum minus p. And in this case, you have q and minus q. So in this order, the processes are going to take place are in this order. The first thing that is going to, so you can think of time going up in this direction. So the first thing that is going to take place is this bulk scattering between p and q. Then the second process is going to take place is the reflection of the q particle, so it's reflection of q. Then you're going to have a bulk scattering matrix here, which is the scattering of minus q with p. And finally, the last thing you hear that of course is that happens is the reflection. Now, if you consider this has to be equal, when the processes occur, it happens in a different order. So essentially, got this, so this is P, this is Q. So that in this case, the first thing that takes place is the reflection of P. The second thing is this is minus P. Q. That is the reflection of Q. And finally, the scattering of between this is minus Q and minus P here. So and if you want this to be integral, this which is if they are matrices instead of factors, this is a non-trivial Mathematician equation, and you have to satisfy this. So this is just by this picture. Okay, so what is going to conform to it? What in the derivative description you can accept open boundary condition by certain degrees. Some indirect cases in the back of radius 5 versus 5 and this D3, D5, or D7, all of them wraps. These three are just the standard Shannon radicals. I mean, you can see only those in which the S3, compact S3, it wraps a sub-sphere of the phi sphere of the and in fact, it's going to be the maximum of Shannon radicals. Then there are also D5 branches which wrap an ADS4 factor of ADS, that has two of S5, and this D7 branch which wraps internally the ADS factor and only an S3 of the S5.
So in this theory, what did D branch correspond to? So the giant graphene corresponds to the giant graphene operator that we can determine. So D5 and D7, what do they correspond to?
Well, the picture is very different between the D3 and D5 and the 7.
Okay.
As you were saying, in the case of the D3, the giant radicals, which are just an operator in front of the n angular momentum, in the case of maximal angular momentum you can have, which is n units, it's just. So in this case, the operator I'm going to be talking about is always in unit for the terms. The operator of the giant maximal giant radical is the determinant of the scalar field inside. Having an open string to it, the investment of the set fields by the product of scalar fields. So this is going to be the. So this is instead of making this part of the paper, which is the string, gauging value by taking the trace, we just contract these three indices with the three indices of this anti-symmetric case. And in the case of this file and this server, right, the work value of the events have this factor that wraps an ADS. Factor of ADS phi again to the boundary of ADS. So in this case, the theory is not just n equal 4, it's n equal 4 plus certain multiples in the momentum to make loop, even different multiples in this. And in the corresponding language. And then there is a subtle theory, and the two cases are different in the case of the D5, since the world value wraps an ADS and ADS 4, it gets to the boundary. Specifies a three-dimensional plane of the four-dimensional boundary. So in that case, in the case of the D5, the matter you are adding gives only the three-dimensional effect. So in these two cases, you have n equal 4 plus matter fields in the four-dimensional formation. So
and I thought that there's a way to get open spin change out of Wilson.
Yeah. So yeah, you could have.
So you insert some operators.
Some operators in the yes, and again you can work it out. There is a paper. There is not much done in that case, but there are papers and one loop showing that a one loop for a specific sample you have is integral. But that's not a problem that is going to persist. To high loops. In fact, this plays in that to the case of the D5 case, the symmetries behind are the same. And in this case, you see that in integrability, spreads from low to high low. So, but I guess that it could happen the same, but it definitely would not. Yes, you can also run with those rules on the various rules.
When you have these hyper multiplets together with n equals 4, is n equals 4 is broken?
Yes, it's broken to to half of it. So in the four dimensional is n equal 2. So let's say I can play a similar game to understand the exact dependence of these diffraction matrices in each of the cases to appear the most reflection cases. And it's interesting because the literature so far was only
looking at the one loop interability in the field theory and the classical interability of the open strings. This was a paper by Samuel and Amelia Mann. And they were able to show that the open string was classically interable in the case of a maximally giant graviton and in the case of the D7, but they failed to prove it for the D5. However, when the results at the weak capping at one loop showed that all the three cases were interable. So you might expect that interability, or you might hope that in these two cases, when you have interability at weak and strong capping, interability would survive for all values of lambda. But in this case, you would expect that higher order, there should be a breakdown of interability because you don't observe interability in the strong capping unit. So another thing which is going to be very general of these three cases is that when working out the residual symmetry that you have to impose to the boundary reflection matrix, there are different cases to be taken into account. Notice that when you specify the world volumes of the D-brains, you always are specifying a subset of the phi sphere, I mean, and a smaller sphere inside of the phi sphere. So the residual symmetry is not only the breakdown of the full symmetry by the ground state, the vacuum state, but also by the relative orientation between this sub-sphere in the phi sphere and the direction where the ground state carries angular momentum is important. So for instance, in the case of maximum giant graviton, you can have two situations. Let's say that the giant graviton always carry momentum in this direction given by Z. But then the situation is going to be different if the ground state is made of wide fields, another kind of, or the same kind of scalar field. So in this case, you are going to break some of the symmetries because you are dealing with two different kind of scalar fields. But in this case, not. I mean, you need some degrees of freedom in the boundary, but they are going also to be treated as impurities. And you will think that the ground state is made of set fields and the giant graviton is made out of set fields, so the full SU2 slash 2 is preserved.
Is there an intuitive understanding of why?
No, well, it's certainly, if the problem is integral at one loop, but it's not integral at
so why that?
Sorry?
Why it's not integral?
Well, again, as I said, I mean, you cannot pull out the possibility of integrability, but the method that succeeded in showing the integrability of these two cases failed in showing the integrability of this one.
So do you expect that if you use a better method, you should be able to show?
I think in this case, we show that you cannot construct the infinite conserved charges. I mean, maybe there's some other method that you can use. I don't know. In some other cases, it's more obvious. For instance, if you have a non-maximal giant graviton, so that there's like this dynamics between the open string and the giant graviton, where the giant graviton basically drags the open string, and you can see that there's kind of instability for the string to start growing. And so you can see that there's some kind of very complicated dynamics. But in this case, so D5, D7, it's really, I don't have like an intuitive.
Anyway, if you want, let's keep the possibility. It might be that it is integral for all loops, and they just fail to contract the charge. But one of the things that I want to show is that this is not the case. There is a breakdown of integrability already at two loops. So I have 5 minutes.
10 minutes.
So let me just, well, as I said, there are going to be very different cases of these three different key rates and the different orientation. But in two cases, for instance, in this election, the D3, and with one of the elections in the D7, the result that you have is this SU1 plus 2. You still can think of the bad manifolds in the fundamental two, but then when you are going to impose what symmetries are concerned, you impose only a subset, SE1 is last two. So in this case, the reflection, I mean, the boundary is just a singlet of the residual symmetry. So the boundary is going to be reflected by demanding the. So it, what you have to demand is this is going to be a 4×4 matrix. You can also, for the fundamental, you can also write the generator, that 4×4 matrix, then you have just to demand the Bacon mute. And if you do that, I mean, for the case of D3, was done by Hoffman and Messina, you just get this exact expression for the S matrix. The only thing you, since you are getting all this from commutators, there is always going to be that overall factor. So this overall factor is not here by this, and in fact, it will depend also on lambda. But later on, you can work it out also with that difference. And the thing is that in these cases, the boundary here back to the equation is away. Despite this being the only trivial because there are these bad scattering ranges here which are non-variable. So this is, anyway, a trivial condition. And so this satisfies, I mean, that the case, the fact that the boundary here back to is away indicates that there is this D3 and also the D7, I consider the collaboration with Yang. So, but let's go quickly to the other case. So, as I said, water fields live in the three-dimensional defects of the mesonic part is broken. The Lorentz is broken to Lorentz in three dimension, and then so 6 is broken. You have an F2, you can be specified by saying x1, x2, and x3 equal to 0. So, it's broken down. SO3 missing 1, 2, and 3, and SO3 missing 4, 5, and 6. And this boundary field, of course, accommodates in the observation of the global symmetries of the field. So the boundary fields are boundary of the chain, and they live in the field. So you have a pair of a doublet of this right SO3, a color field. So it's a single of Lorentz, and it has dimensions 1/2. And then you have the by spinors of this Lorentz in three dimensions, and also a doublet of the other SO3. And of course, it's in three dimensions, which is the first half dimension. So then the operator Q and one open string is going to be like a chain, and then you use this fundamental and fundamental to make it gauge invariant. And if when you work it out, when you consider the full symmetries of the theory, how are they broken by the election of the ground state, you see that a single symmetry is a diagonal combination of the two SU2 factors of the bank. So you have only a single SU2/2 factor. So, but as I said, I mean, is this now both the bank manuals propagating the chain and also the boundary fields had to accommodate in reducing the representation of this diagonal decimal symmetry. They will come with the definite value of lambda minus j. So if you think of the two possibilities, the two orientations that I was talking about, where they take j to be in the direction 1, 2, so the scalar fields are not judged under this j, so most of them have j equal to 0, so then they can be accommodated in a multiple with 1/2, delta minus j equal to 1/2. And if you, and the Fermis are going to have charged j set plus half or minus 1/2. So you can take one of the orientations to also to contribute to this multiple. So in this case, these four fields can build the fundamental representation. There is a simple case. If you take this under orientation, now the color fields are charged under this J set.
So the lowest value you can have of delta minus j is equal to zero, and the only field that satisfies this is one of the two scalars of the linear effect. So this is, if you use this for the right boundary, this is going to be a signal of the decimal. So let us go and consider in this case, and then you have to ask how the bulk magnets accumulating to the representations of the infrasimal symmetry. And you see that, well, they are the fundamental, from the bulk point of bulk symmetry point of view, they are the fundamental, the two factors, that is, from the diagonal symmetry, from the point of view of the diagonal symmetry, they transform in this product of fundamental. So it's a 16 dimensional representation. So the reflection matrix is going to be 16 by 16. And again, doing the same thing, you can impose the commutation of this with the generators, this diagonal, SC2/2, and you get that the bosonic symmetries constrain the reflection to be of this form, and the fermionic ones constrain the exact expressions of the of these functions up to another factor. Notice that I use these spectral parameters, which have a hidden dependence on the top coupling, so there is a dependence, not really a dependence on the top coupling in this. And well, if you take in this expression g equal to zero, you recover the one result, and in fact, reconcile in the paper of the Wolf and Mann, where they show the integrability of one loop. So, But if you look at exact expressions, there are many components, if you consider the difference of these two factorizations, there are many components which are non-vanishing. How could it be consistent with the one of integrability? Well, of course, what you need is this is going to vanish if you take g going to zero, but if you look at a wicked happy expansion of this non-vanishing component, the first order is g squared. So maybe this exact expression is already telling you that this is going to be integral at one loop, and the integrality is going to break at already at two loops. And it's consistent with the failure of Samuel and Gilliard to work without all the conserved charges in the classical limit for lambda to infinity. So this is just a summary. So there were a couple of possible orientations for each case. In the case where integral both orientation for integral, in that case, both possible orientations fail to satisfy the equation. But I will skip, you can use crossing symmetry to work it out the overall factor. But let me just go to the summary and the final comments. So, what I show you so far is that you can use this scattering of magnets in the spin chains to study the spectral problem in the planar link of neutral forces to the anneals. And eventually, you can use this asymptotic better answer to work it out the all loop spectrum for these operators. Using the residual symmetry, it is possible to fix exactly the dependence of the scattering matrices. The dependence of the matrices on the top coupling constant, the overall factor left can be fixed using this crossing symmetry, which we guys skipped. And then you can play the same way to work on the reflection matrices to study the problem when you have open boundary conditions. In that case, the reflection matrix is turned out to be integral for the D3 and the 7, but it failed to satisfy Young Bachtel equation in the case of the D5 matrix. So is that it? Certainly not, because what I was saying, eventually I would like to apply this for an operator of finite size, the trace of the finite length. You may think that, okay, let us compute better equations using this exact S matrix, the dependence on lambda is exact.
But it's not expected to this should not give an exact result, because in doing this asymptotic red answer, I was making certain effects, which is essentially this wrapping effect, which, as I said, is when the length of the range of the interaction exceeds is longer than the length of the chain itself. So you can try to work it out and you can make an explicit computation to see how much does it fail to get the answer. But this is a very difficult computation because this wrapping effect is not going to appear until a high order in the expansion. As I said, I mean, this wrapping effect is on the lambda to the L, where L is the length of the chain. Now, let's think of the SU sector. The shortest non-BPS thread you can have in the SU sector has L equal 4. If you have L equal 3, you use the density of the trace, it's always going to be BPS, so there's not going to be a whole thing. So you have to go to L equal 4 to observe a mixing between these two operators, and calculate explicitly the number of dimensions and compare what you would obtain if you use the exact asymptotic mediance and the following. And there is a disagreement with this, and there were many people working in this direction, but the final result was coming out by this collaboration. So it would be nice to see if it is possible to have a way account for this finite size effect. Analytically somehow, and then compare with the physical computation in this case. Well, that was done by Yannick for this case. Let me see another motivation for Oakhopper and the condition. So in this single case, the VPS, the ground state is almost VPS, it does not receive any correction with the ground state energy in finite size. However, in the Oakhopper and the condition cases, even the background state is not a VPS operator. So even the vacuum state you see quantum correction. And finite side correction to the ground state are much more easier to incorporate than finite side correction to excited state in the chain and in these models. In fact, in the simpler case, the finite side correction of one of the vacuum should be applied by two uniforms. So if you work it out the analytic method in order to test this method, it could be much easier in the open quantum case, because you have to do a computation in the simplest case as to do. So just, I won't say much, but the idea behind the incorporation of finite size effect is this thermodynamic variance, which is a method that you can work it out with finite size corrections entirely in terms of the reflection and scattering matrices of the infinite size, so the asymptotic ones, which are known to be exact. If you do that, and you have an expression for instance, the correction of the ground, the state energy, these are the exact reflection matrices, the asymptotic ones, but this depends on this function, usually known as pseudo energy, which is a solution of this very complicated equation. So, but I mean, what the ingredients here are the S matrices of the infinite size, the reflection and the S matrix of infinite size. So somehow in the infinite size reflection matrix is encoded all what you need to know to work it out the finite size effect. So what I'm working currently is in a lot of subtleties, but I don't have yet the result because you need to know a lot of information which is not known yet as the reflection of an infinite number of bounded data that has been different, that there is in the theory, but I hope that soon we can work it out this finite size correction to bounded data and eventually compare it with this in a simple tube computation. So you know, it should stop now.
Speaker again.